Progressive Radio Network.
It may be the thinking person station, but sometimes I think this host doesn't have a brain. How are you, my friends? It's the Progressive Radio Network. My name's Mark Farrell. The show is Insight. Happy Thursday to you. Hold on a second. My headphones aren't in the right spot here. Here we go. I'm feeling good now. I'm in total denial. It's Labor Day weekend. How can this be? How can it be? Where did the 3 months of summer go? The endless long days. Of course, the heat is still upon us, which I like. You know, we'll take that. That sounds pretty good, right? Always love the heat. Bring it on. That's what I say. Anyway, so we got a great show, a jam-packed show. We have Carol Glazer, president of the National Organization on Disability. This organization promotes the full participation and contributions of America's 56 million people with disabilities in all aspects of life, which we talk about often here on the show. And the other day, if I sound a little bit hoarse, I went to a Bruce show, and it was phenomenal. And this is one reason why it was phenomenal. Yeah, there's nothing like a Bruce show. You know, I haven't seen Bruce in probably about 3 or 4 years, and I did myself a major disservice because he's just the consummate performer on every level, and he just epitomizes what a show should be. Okay, not everybody needs to have a 4-plus-hour show, which he had, which was totally incredible. Not only did he break his record, he broke the world record for longest performance. So kudos to Bruce, the boss from Freehold, New Jersey. Incidentally, that's where I'm from. So I kind of have an extra affinity for the Bruce. My mom actually went to high school with his mother, Adele, and they remain sort of friends, loose friends, throughout the years. And once in a while, we hear what he's been up to in his personal fronts through my mother, I should say. And it's just a great connection. But the concert itself, I mean, this guy did not want to get off stage. And that is just, I think, epitomizes why somebody does something they do in life. Whether it's being a musician, somebody who is really into the job and career that they have, it's so telltale that they're so passionate about it. Like when I get up on stage and people tell me, oh my God, you are so into what you do, your zeal and passion. It's just when you are in the right field, you know, it's like a relationship, like when you're in love with the right person, whether it's a marriage or not, but it just feels good. It works. It clicks. There's a groove. There's a chemistry. And that's why things work, right? So the Bruce show, it just makes me realize that whether it's music, there's so many different things that when they gel, man, they really, really gel. And it's just a testimonial to his passion. And also to the fans, their incredible endurance, I should say, because, all right, so we didn't have seats. We had general admission for the floor. So we were there for 4+ hours standing. And I couldn't imagine being up on stage enduring that. But then there's some kids there, you know, so it's a great first show. I mean, I don't know how a kid's going to endure that, you know, under 15 years old, 10 years old, et cetera. But it is a great crowd, very affable. And this crowd needs no prompting, and it's kind of a cult following in the sweetest, most endearest form of saying the word cult following, because it's great. People are just so into his music, and that's great. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about Bruce and playing a bit more of his clips, because, you know, when you have an iPhone, hey, anything's possible, right? So we're going to be meeting Carol Glazer in just a few minutes. And also, this is pretty incredible. She's got one foot on a plane heading to Rio and the other foot in the terminal waiting for us to call in a little while. Allie Jones is an incredible Paralympian. She's done, I think, this is her 8th or 6th games. She does winter and summer. I think she's no longer doing winter, but she's a cyclist. So we're going to be talking to her in just a few minutes so she can plane. And we're going to be very, very excited to hear about all her goals and aspirations going into Rio. And also, I'm sure you heard the news, the sad news. Gene Wilder, great actor, I think really underrated. big time underrated. And I have to tell you, one of the first times, obviously, we all probably first were introduced to Gene Wilder in Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory. But when I was older, I saw a movie called The Woman in Red. And there's a scene that, if you remember this movie, you'll remember the scene once I paint the picture for you, because I can really relate to this on many levels because of my back then lack of driving situation and now driving situation with the assistance of a telescopic device, which is like what a surgeon wears to operate with those little telescopes on the outside of his glasses. So basically the scene is that they pull up to a restaurant, like four or five guys, looks like it's guys' night out, they're all married and they're going out for, you know, break some bread, have some drinks, whatever. So they get out of the car, they pull up in front, and they're all like, well, whose turn is it? Whose turn is it? And they're all like, you go. So it's Gene Wilder's turn. And in this scene, you don't know what they're talking about. So they walk into the restaurant, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh, okay, Gene's going to pretend to be blind. So Gene sits down, and the short of it is, basically, they're looking for a free meal. So they get to the restaurant table, and then the waiter hands him something, and you know, Gene, of course, can see, but he pretends he can't see. And next thing you know, the menu goes on fire because he's holding it over the candle. All the restaurant workers feel really bad, the waiters, and then the manager comes over, things get spilled, you know, and this is just hysterical because obviously the audience is in on the joke. So it's really dynamite. Now, the piece de resistance is after this long meal where they gorge themselves, right? And they're, you know, three sheets to the wind, I'm sure. This isn't a long time ago I saw this movie, but again, this scene remains in my Pentium upstairs. So they're about to leave, and the owner's like, no check. We feel really bad because they feel totally embarrassed about how they treated their patron who is blind, supposedly, wink, wink. So they're like, okay, thank you, we appreciate it. So they walk out to the car, and all the staff is watching Gene Wilder, who's supposedly blind, and all the his friends at the time walking out to the car. And all of a sudden, Gene Wilder opens the door to the driver's side, pops in, sits down, shuts the door, and they drive off. So the restaurant got scammed. It's a great scene. So the reason why it's really funny for obvious reasons, but for me especially, is because there's been so many times where, you know, I can't read menus, I break out my magnifier, and there's so many different other examples to it, but then I get behind the wheel of a car, but it's legal, you know, with these glasses that I have. Excuse me again. It's legal. So I can relate to it. Obviously, it's a prank, but it's a great prank. And we'll miss certainly Gene Wilder's work with Richard Pryor and all the other movies that he did. And he was just a great guy, very well liked. And he was married, if you remember, to, oh my God, I just forgot her name, from Saturday Night Live. Little tiny sweater ball driving, rotting right down your face. Oh my God, she died of cancer. Oh, she's got a facility on the Lower East Side. Gina, not Davis. It'll come to me. I'm sorry. I'm remiss in remembering this. It's been a long week. How about you? I could use a three-day weekend. So, you know, it's been a really, really bad couple of years for law enforcement. Really horrific on many, many fronts. And this news story is no different. Daniel Harris, he was shot to death the other day, I think on Wednesday, by a North Carolina state trooper after a chase, because he was scared that the police, under several misunderstandings with officers, Daniel was deaf and he was shot to death. So now Daniel's brother Sam, who is also deaf, said that they are all too often inaccessible to deaf people, talking about police. Relating to his own story about how he ended up with a gun to his face because he, too, is deaf and couldn't follow the officer's shouted orders. So we've heard about the inability of law enforcement to interact with persons with mental illness. Could you imagine being someone who's hearing impaired or completely deaf and realizing maybe you're driving down the road and all of a sudden you look up and you see the lights behind you? You don't know how long possibly they've been there because we've all been distracted by other things when we're driving. So, and then if you get pulled over and he's shouting instructions via the bullhorn from his car or walks up to your window, you can't understand what he's saying. Some people are able to communicate who are deaf, have the ability to speak and certainly be communicable. Others are not, but there's got to be a way to form some type of communication, international or a national, that says, hey, listen, I'm hearing impaired, some signal, some hand signal, some gesture, something. So Daniel Harris had arrests in several states on minor charges, including three for resisting police officers. Hey, and this guy may not have been a saint by all means, but, you know, it still goes to say that, you know, we want to paint an accurate picture. But the reality is he shouldn't have been shot. But those charges in 2010 in Florida and 2008 in Denver were dropped. He pleaded guilty to suffering, blah, 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 blah. Details of the arrest were not available. But authorities have released few details about the shooting, including why Trooper Jermaine Sanders fired at the end of a 10-mile chase that started at 6:15 p.m. When he did not pull over. Daniel Harris, that is, the deaf driver, tried to stop him for speeding in an interstate, but he did not. So the police officer, Saunders, 28, has been placed on administrative duty. Harris's family, the victim's family, said he was unarmed. The State Bureau of Investigation has not said whether any weapon was found on or near Harris. So now the family is raising funds for Harris's funeral and plans to use any extra money to begin a foundation to help educate police officers on interacting with the hearing impaired. Certainly it's a vital, vital program. For bringing, you know, we can avoid this, certainly, for computerized systems to alert officers that they're dealing with a deaf driver. I mean, that's a no-brainer. I mean, if you're pulling over someone and they put in the plates of Mark Farrell, boop, 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 and it comes up, this guy should not be on the road because he's visually impaired, but he wears some funky glasses, so handle him with care. No, I wouldn't say that. But it would come up saying, driver Mark Farrell is hearing impaired. So there should be a protocol in place that would allow them to, you know, understand what the situation will entail. So that's a no-brainer, right? It's a no-brainer, absolutely. Because, I mean, this kid is, you know, he's just a kid, and he's shot. And he has a son, a 3-year-old son, Daniel Harris. And again, he may have not been a squeaky clean individual. We don't know that for sure because everything was dropped. All the charges were dropped. But the sad fact of the matter is that this man's life is over for being deaf. For being deaf, he has no future. He has no future role as a father. And this is a conversation that needs to continue because, especially for those with mental illness, the reality is when a police officer, you know, it's such a scary role being a police officer. When you pull someone over, you never, never know who you're going to be dealing with, correct? I mean, you could pull up to a soccer mom. You could pull up to pull over a serial killer. I mean, you never know. You know, I always have my excuses ready. Oh, you know, I'm just very candid and say, you know, hi, officer, here's the deal. And then they look at my glasses and they're like, what are you wearing? You can tell by their face that they don't articulate this, but they're looking at me going, what is this guy wearing? Should this cat be behind the wheel driving? My God. Then I hand them my paperwork and then they're like, I'm like, oh, yeah, I have a permanent visual impairment. These glasses allow me to drive. And they look at me and they're like, oh, okay, at least I kind of have a some understanding, some semblance of what this guy's doing and wearing, because otherwise, you know, they would have no idea and be utterly confused. I remember when I had my learner's permit, I was pulled over, and it's not like your typical learner's permit. It was a card. I didn't have that at the time. It was just, I'd say, 4 or 5, 6 pieces of paper. I remember handing it to this officer, and it was late. It was probably like 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. Came from a bar. I wasn't drinking. And I hand all this paperwork to an officer, and he starts kind of loosely, you know, flipping the pages, and he looks at me, and I said, I know, I couldn't make head or tails of this. He goes, hands it back to me, goes, just be safe and have a good night. Because, you know, the paperwork was just, you know, confusing as well. First of all, how are you supposed to read all that paperwork on a dark highway road? You know, no crazy idea, concept there. Also, I want to bring to your attention that there was a great, great show that I kind of learned about a little bit late. It's called The Night Of, and the season finale just aired this past Sunday on HBO. And the crux of this story is, I think there are only about maybe 5 episodes, too. Extremely well done. Some great characters, some well-known, mostly unknown to me. But the crux of the story is how one person's life was changed forever by making the wrong decision. And how many times does that happen to so many people that we know in life that ultimately they don't have to end up in jail? Like the this particular show, The Night Of, the star ended up in jail. Essentially, he met this woman, went back to her house, did a lot of drugs that he's not accustomed to doing at all. He is Pakistani, I believe, and she was Caucasian American. And he woke up and she was stabbed 22 times and he freaked out and ran out, completely blacked out. So the whole four or five episodes works up to the fact that they're in court and is he guilty? All this evidence gets unearthed, etc. And it's interesting how what he decides to do in the jail situation to keep his head above water. Because we all have to make the decisions in life. What do we have to do to, you know, pay our bills, stay in a relationship, make things healthy, etc.? So when you're in Rikers Island awaiting a trial, you know, do you align yourself with a different population just to stay alive? I don't know. I would think so, because going the solo route. So the reason why I bring this attention to you, this matter to your attention, this show that was on HBO, The Night Of, because it's just a really, really eye-opening experience about our actions have consequences. Of course, you know, I'm not saying that any of us, you know, sit here and do drugs on the weekends and that's why we, you know, have things happen to us. But it could be any little thing. By losing your job and you go through your 2 or 3 months savings that you have set aside, next thing you know, your house is foreclosed. Next thing you know, your marriage is on the rocks. Next thing you know, you don't have any place to live. You're separated from your family. You're on the streets of New York City. Next thing you know, you're suffering from mental illness or you have a disability and or the medication that you're on for your entire life or for 6 months you're unable to afford. That's how quickly things change in life. So I thought this movie was great. And it's sure, it's that's one variable of the show, The Night Of on HBO, that I'm sure you can watch on demand for ever, I'm sure, on HBO. But it's just kind of eye-opening because there's so many great aspects to them, to the show and the series. But it made me think about how one action can change the trajectory of your life. And I know there's a lot of legislation in place right now that they're trying to, number one, jails are overcrowded big time. So what they're trying to do is lessen the offense and or jail time of first-time offenders and or the bail that's permitted, because a lot of people go to jail for the first time without any history of violence or weapons or whatever the case may be. Next you know, they can't afford to even get out of jail. So this is how the system corrupts somebody who's not corrupt. So the individual who's the star of this show, The Night Of on HBO, he aligns himself with a bad circuit of people. I'm sure there was worse clientele in the jail. But next thing you know, he's starting to do, you can't tell, it's either heroin or a bunch of other drugs, just to kind of keep sane. And this will be a little bit of a spoiler alert, so just turn down your whatever device you're listening on. I'll give you 5 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so he's not cleared, but he's not jailed. He gets out of jail because they find out who the real murderer is, but that he's going to have to be tried, and I'm sure he'll be vindicated. But they show him getting high after he gets out of jail, because that's not something you can shake. You can't shake 6 months or a year of Rikers Island off by having a bundt cake that your mom made when you get home from prison. Of all the sleepless nights, all the horrific dreams, all the intimidation, all the violent acts that you probably incurred, experienced, and suffered. Okay, turn it back up. I'm done talking about that. I won't spoil anything for you. So, yeah, it's kind of a dark topic, but, you know, we always kind of keep it light around here. But I think that's something you really owe yourself to see, because on many levels, number one, it's entertaining as hell. And number two, I think there's just a lot of great, it's a great conversation if you're ever looking for conversation when you're at your next cocktail party or at your Labor Day party. Can you believe it's Labor Day? I can't believe it's Labor Day. Carol Glazer is in the studio, ladies and gentlemen. Carol, pull yourself up to that microphone.
Okay.
Don't be shy.
All right.
How are you, my dear? Let me shake your hand.
Shake your hand.
Real pleasure to meet you. I'm going to have you get a little closer to that microphone.
Okay.
How are the streets out in New York City? Still wet?
It's hot and wet and clammy. It's great to be here. Thank you, Mark. Yes.
Carol Glazer, we should tell people who you are again.
Okay, I'm the president of the National Organization on Disability.
Oh, you're doing my job for me. I was going to do that, but
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I thought it was a question. I heard your voice go off.
No.
All right, I'll keep my mouth shut until asked.
My jeans are a little too tight. That's why my voice goes up. Anyway, so this is an incredible organization, and I told your colleague who's sitting next to you in your room, who's equally nicely dressed, you guys are a pretty attractive bunch over there. So it's Nod?
Summer White. We don't say Nod. We say N-O-D.
N-O-D, okay. NOD. I would have to visit you guys sometime.
I'd love it if you would.
So at NOD and in your community in general, I would just like to say, and this is not a disparaging remark about employers, but is it just safe to say that employers are just scared as hell because of lack of education, information about hiring people with disabilities, and what will happen to them when they do hire them?
Well, I think you hit it. I think it's fears, it's misperceptions, it's stereotypes, and you know, we can't forget history and the fact that until only maybe about 40 years ago, a lot of people with disabilities were not seen. They were not known. People with cognitive or mental health impairments were institutionalized. They were sent away where they could be cared for by specially trained people. And where they wouldn't pose a harm to themselves or their community. This harkens back to your previous topic, Mark. And people with physical disabilities didn't have curb cuts, didn't have access to buildings, and so they stayed at home.
Essentially ostracized.
Pretty much segregated from the rest of society, physically segregated from the rest of society, unlike other minority groups who are segregated, but who you encounter in one form or other in your life. And so, yes, there's fear of the unknown, and that's where it all starts.
And I think that maybe we become the impression of, well, this is how this section of the population has been treated for all these years, been institutionalized and or marginalized and or sidelined, even though we had a president, FDR, who was in a wheelchair. But that's okay. That's only one person, and he was an anomaly. But then this is just the way it is, and we're just going to continue to do business this way.
Because that's right.
Should we do it differently? Because we don't want to, you know, go through the glass ceiling and be the first ones to hire 100 people as a Fortune 500 company to prove to people that, you know, these people have valuable skill sets. Their absenteeism rate is what? Incredibly low.
It's very low. It's considerably lower than most employees. It could be because people are afraid of how long it would take to find another job. But for whatever the reason, people with disabilities where employers have taken that step, and hire them, brought them into and created a more inclusive workforce with them as part of it, have seen reduced absenteeism, higher retention rates, greater loyalty, greater production.
Productivity. I really want to underscore the productivity aspect.
Productivity is huge. And look, you have to just imagine that people who spend their lives navigating a world that wasn't built for them have to develop incredible problem-solving skills, workarounds, tenacity, persistence, all of the things that employers say they value most, even beyond the technical skills that are valued in the workplace, are those so-called soft skills, those personal attributes that make somebody a good worker. And if you think about people with disabilities who have been marginalized, who have had to elbow their way in whatever way they could into the mainstream of society and now increasingly into the workforce, this is a tremendous workforce that can really pay off. So we say at my organization, at NOD, the exclusion of people with disabilities from the workforce is not only an historic injustice, and it's not merely a matter of equal opportunity. It's a terrible waste of talent that could be enriching the American workforce.
And that's a high percentage of talent that's being wasted, correct? It's 80-some-odd percent of people with disabilities who are able and capable?
Correct. We have, and don't forget, Mark, you know, disability is much more common than perhaps people realize.
Invisible disability, number one. I'll raise my hand right here.
One-third of all disability is mental health disability.
Most disabilities are
invisible.
Sure.
And so, in truth, one out of every five Americans has a disability. And if you include parents and spouses and others in their sphere, sphere of influence, you're probably pretty close to one out of every two people. And that number is growing. My generation, the baby boom generation, as we age into disability. So that number is only growing. It's a huge number, and it's one that we have to start taking account of.
I say to audiences when I speak to college kids, whatever the audience age or demographic would be, I say everyone in this room has a disability. And we're all going to become more disabled, whether it's apparent or perceived, real or not. I mean, it's That's the way right. we think. It's the way we act. We all
yeah.
do.
We say, yeah.
And it's how we define ourselves.
At NOD, we say there are two things that we say about disability. One is that it is the largest minority group mm-hmm. and one that anyone can join at any time.
Oh, absolutely.
And we also say there are only two types of people, those who are disabled and those who are temporarily able-bodied.
Absolutely. It's so well said. And I don't know if you were able to hear this on the right before you came into the room here, but we have a Paralympian athlete who's going to join us. And if you have a few minutes to stay around.
Would love to.
She's basically getting on a plane to go to Rio for the Paralympics, yes. which I'm sure you guys embrace as well.
Oh, we do.
And very quickly, this is a little bit of a sidebar. So what do you think about the Paralympics being always following the Olympics?
Well, I always look at the glass half full. And when you look at the numbers of viewers, Mark, who are watching the Paralympics, and when you look at those who are advertising and giving their advertising dollars to the Paralympics, you see a very steady and fairly aggressive increase. And
Absolutely,
so
sure.
maybe it won't be long before the Paralympics are before the Olympics.
Well, that's what I say, and I don't want to get too far off topic here, but I think the reality is it would benefit the host city. It's a great soft ramp-up time for them because,
that's
obviously,
right.
you know, get tens and tens of thousands of people for the Olympics. For the Paralympics, a little bit smaller. It's a great little trial period. And it's a great way to drum up the enthusiasm for the Olympics, and also Americans and international audiences would just clamor when people see just how incredible these athletes
That's
are.
That's right.
And just
right.
how people who are incredibly talented and go to their job every day in a workforce with disabilities are just as a hero as the people who get a medal or do not get a medal, because whatever you have to try at and become good at doing every day, day in and day out.
That's right.
Even just to get dressed sometimes for a person with a disability.
That's
or to
correct.
Get over your fears, the mental hurdles you have to do just to get yourself into the office.
That's
then
right.
once you're there, you got the job and you think it's all a piece of cake. No. But then you probably have to worry about some office mates and mm-hmm. how you communicate with them, or because it's a whole different level of communication depending on your disability. So I imagine that's also the next thing I want to get into is how you educate employers who certainly want to enter the world of being a little bit more inclusive.
Yes.
I think that's probably one ramification is dealing with employers employees, I should say, of employers in terms of how they interact.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You know, the first thing that we like to tell employers is it's really not that complicated. This is not that hard. It's not that heavy a lift. Number one, you hire people all the time. So hiring, there's no mystique to hiring. You take a chance on somebody based on some very good intelligence you get about that person's skills and abilities and past experience. But also then there's that gut decision. And so ultimately, you make a hiring decision. You do it all the time. If you make a mistake, you fire the person. It's something that is routine practice. And don't think about bringing people with disabilities into your workforce any differently from hiring just about anybody else. It's not a heavy lift. The other thing to realize is there are a lot of misperceptions around the cost of hiring someone with a disability. We've already talked about absenteeism and productivity and reduced safety violations and all the track record and the experience that employers have. But there's a fear about health costs. Well, that fear is misplaced as well. The health costs for people with disabilities in the workplace are not any greater than the health costs for any other employee. There's a fear about the cost of accommodations. We know that the vast majority, 75% of all accommodations, whether it's a screen reader or some other way of helping somebody with a visual impairment be able to adapt and be able to read and be able to communicate along with their coworkers, the cost of those accommodations are relatively negligible. And in fact, we don't even use the word accommodations. Accommodations, because it's a word that's in the ADA. It's a word that signals compliance. It's a word that has all kind of legal connotations to it. And you see lawyers come running out of the woodwork when you talk about accommodation. We like to talk about productivity supports. And every employer has some type of productivity support that they offer to just about everybody who works for them. And the costs for those with disabilities are a little bit greater. They are a little bit greater, but they're not as great as many employers would fear. So much of the numbers and the fact that people are not being hired in large numbers is really based on fear and misapprehension. And so we start with trying to debunk some of those myths. But then, yes, there are a lot of good practices. And now, of course, if you're a federal contractor, and that means it's a very, very low threshold. All you have to do to meet that requirement is do more than $50,000 a year worth of business with the federal government annually. So federal contractors employ 40% of the nation's workforce. So this is a very big group of employers.
It's a huge number.
They now have to set a 7% workforce goal across the board, every single job category, people with disabilities in their workforce. So if they didn't want to do it and have a desire to do it, now they have to. And so the motivation for including this workforce is greater than it's ever been before. But we also have to think about the race for talent. In the next 5 to 6 years, industry is going to need upwards of 44 million new workers to replace boomers who are retiring and to fill new jobs that are being created. Where are we going to find those people?
That's a gargantuan number.
And you've got a ready pool of about 24 million working-aged Americans who are able and ready and willing to go to work who are not working right now. So you have this tremendous labor force need on the one hand. You have this tremendous pool of untapped talent on the other. And so if you weren't motivated by compliance and you weren't motivated by wanting to be an equal opportunity employer.
Or by decency.
Think about the race for talent. So there's all kinds of motivation and all kinds of reasons why we're very optimistic that the numbers are going to start changing, maybe slowly, but the numbers are going to start changing. The employers who have done this, and it's everything from how you portray yourself. You know, the numbers also tell us that consumers will switch brands to companies who are known to hire people with disability. There's tremendous brand loyalty. There's tremendous impetus about having a workforce that reflects your customer base.
And that's what companies want. I mean, brand loyalty, they'll do anything to have their consumers stick with something,
absolutely,
their product.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is as you look at the increasing numbers, you see about $550 billion of annual purchasing power just for people with disabilities. And if you look at the larger pool of those who are in their sphere, you see almost $4 trillion worth of purchasing power. And so companies want to have in their workforce a representation of their customer base so that they can know how their customers think, how their customers act, what their customers are going to buy. Right. So if you start thinking about all of the reasons why it's really important to do this, it becomes easy to start thinking about the relatively inexpensive ways. How are you perceived by the public? Do you have people with disabilities shown on your website when you're advertising for a job and somebody goes and looks at your website, or when you're shopping around, somebody looks at your website? Do people see themselves on your website? Do you have a culture of inclusion? Do you have senior level people in your organization who are self-identifying as people
exactly.
with disabilities?
Exactly. Management level, that's a huge thing I have a problem with.
Right. And we know that culture is so important. Mm-hmm. And we know, as you say, Mark, that culture starts from the top and that it's really the CEO who calls the shots. Are you rewarding your managers for hiring people with disabilities? Is it built into your incentive system? Are you training people? Are you training people on disability awareness and disability etiquette because of our fears? We don't know. People don't know how to talk to people in wheelchairs. Now, my son, who's 24, has both cognitive and physical disabilities, but he's quite intelligent. He's actually one of the smartest people I know. He's a tremendous intuition. When he goes into a restaurant, people ask me what he wants.
It's absurd, isn't it?
People speak slowly.
Like he's an infant.
Yes, as if he's an infant. People speak slowly. And he's so kind-hearted that he will be very patient in listening. And then afterwards, he'll say, was there something wrong with that waiter who talked to me really slowly?
You know what I would love? What's your son's name?
His name is Jacob.
I would love if Jacob looked at you and said, you should tell the waiter or waitress that I would like to have yada, 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 yada.
That's what he does. Well, okay. I usually don't let him. Okay. I usually say, I think he can speak. Why don't you ask him what he wants? And then he goes off. He knows exactly what he wants. And he'll tell you, I want the ketchup on the side. And I want it right on the burger. And please leave lettuce over here. And people's eyes pop out because they're so surprised. More debunking of
well, it's just like everything in life. If you're not exposed to something, whether it's racism, sexism, a diverse clientele, wherever you're raised, I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, they know about people with disabilities and how to interact. And I'm pretty impressed with that because then it's just going to be a natural part of their life and who they are and their environment and not think differently, because that's the problem. And as a matter of fact, there's a great article, I think, in the New York Times, was it yesterday or day before, about how we view the great divide of people with or without disabilities.
That's right.
And I only read a portion of it, but it's so spot on about how we just continue to make the divide.
Yes, and it's funny because there are really two ways that we tend to manifest this this misapprehension. On the one hand, you have what I call the tyranny of low expectations, right? So you have the waiter who thinks my son can't speak and addresses me, even though he can. And all across the board, whether it's our neighbors or our doorman or the postman or the teachers even, or other people in the community, we always tend to expect less of people with disabilities than we expect of anybody else. And that expectation really sets in. So it becomes part of your internalized view of yourself, and it becomes very hard to expect a lot of yourself if people on the outside aren't expecting much of you. So you have that one side of expecting less. But then you have that other side of often we heroize people with disabilities. We say, that person with no arms and no legs with a paintbrush in her mouth who's painting the picture, oh my God, that person is unbelievable. Well, you know what? Like Darwin said, it's not the strongest people. It's not even the most intelligent people. It's the people who adapt.
Adaptation, baby. So right? Well put.
And
so well put. And we
that
do.
Person,
we do.
She's painting. That's how she learned how to paint.
That's all she knows.
And that's what you or
no
I would do.
Correct.
We would adapt. Yes, it takes longer to get out of bed and get yourself into work in the morning if you're in a wheelchair and you have to go through all the transfers and so on. But that person is doing just what you or I would do. We use terms like exceptional or special because it's, in some ways, disability is almost like an unspeakable condition that we can only refer to in euphemisms.
And I think people feel it's a safe way to look in to this divide that we have, but to not look down on them, to also to put them up, because it makes them feel better about looking into an area that usually makes them feel uncomfortable.
You're so right about that. So astute, Mark. There's a wonderful comedian. Her name is Stella Young.
Oh, by the way, can I interrupt you?
Yes.
Who was Gene Wilder married to? Who was his first?
Gilda Radner.
Gilda Radner, that's it. Thank you. It was driving me nuts.
She's my idol.
Oh, she was great.
My alter ego. Oh, I'm going to cry now. You talk about
I don't
Gilda.
Know if you heard me do my segment before about Gene Wilder.
Oh, no.
Basically, remember the woman in red where they go to the restaurant, he pretends he's blind, comes out.
And no.
It's great. You have to rent it.
Oh, yeah.
So my point was, because when I walk out of a restaurant and get in the car and I use my magnifier to read a menu and I drive with my glasses on, I get in the car and people probably look at me like, well, how can this guy drive? But the whole thing is a big shtick about getting a free meal. So he's with these friends. They go out and he drives. After he set the menu on fire, he points the cane and hits the waiter and drinks spill, and they get in the car and they laugh and they'll drive
Isn't
away.
Isn't that good? That gets us all to confront our misperceptions.
That comedian,
right?
You said?
Stella Young. She's fabulous. I highly recommend. She did a wonderful TED Talk, and it's about inspiration porn. And it's just what you said, Mark.
I did not think we were going there today, Carol. I did not think.
You want to talk about
it? Oh, absolutely.
I'm happy to talk about inspiration porn.
Sure, bring it on.
Look, we have to think. What is
inspiration? Hey, we're progressive here.
Porn is the objectification of one group of people for the benefit of another.
Yes.
Any kind of porn is that way. And so this notion of heroizing people for doing nothing more than getting out of bed every day and remembering their name because they have a disability is really inspiration of thinking they're a hero. And she begins her TED Talk by talking about how the teacher one day, she's a small person and she's a wheelchair user. And she when she was 8 years old, her mother got a visit from the school teachers who said they wanted to give her an award, an achievement award. And the mother said, well, that's really great, but my daughter really hasn't achieved anything. And it kind of blew their mind because she was willing to just straight away confront them. You know, she said, I was
good
a kid.
Her.
I watched Buffy the Vampire. She's Australian. I guess that's some kid's show. And I watched Buffy the Vampire, get up every day. You know, I like to eat sweets. I never achieved anything. And why do they want to give me an award? Well, they really want to give her an award for somehow or other making her way into school every day. And that is what she calls inspiration porn. And it's
great.
A very
right.
funny
right.
TED Talk.
And it makes them feel better.
Yes, exactly. No matter how bad my life is,
yes.
no matter how bad, I can look at your life and know it could be worse.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what inspiration porn is about.
Yeah. An aside to that, basically, I have a brother who took his life about 25 years ago. And when I used to go in support groups, et cetera, that we would all talk about different things, what we're coping with. And other people would tell stories about how their loved one took their life. And in the back of my mind, I'd be like, oh, my God, thank God my brother didn't do that. I'm a little better off.
Right.
You know, but
yes.
we all have that, like,
yeah,
little
course.
Switch. You know, it's
yeah.
a survival mechanism, you
it's
know?
It's human.
How
it
do
is
we,
human.
You know, our ego or ability to survive and adapt, as we talked about before, adaptation, is great. Carol yeah. Glazer, do you like Bruce? Bruce Springsteen?
Oh, yeah, I love Bruce Springsteen.
All right, play it, Zach.
Although I guess I should have known who he was, Mark.
Carol Glazer is the president of National Organization on Disability. She's my guest, and she's a diehard Bruce fan, aren't you, Carol?
I am.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
How could you not be?
It's my generation.
All right. So we only got a few minutes left before we meet somebody who's in a Paralympian. I'm not going to say she's excellent. She's not superb on every level, because then we're going to be what?
Paralympians do deserve our respect.
A little bit. Yeah. A little bit. Okay. Well, that's why she's on the show. So if I own I'm not going to say a Fortune 500 business, but I'm a business owner of, what would you say, what is a business?
Let's say REI. REI is a wonderful company, and that CEO wants to do something great.
Exactly. So how do you go about that?
Well, you go and in
if,
and well, you...
More importantly, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Carol,
sure.
but what if you don't have the budget for REI to afford a consultants?
Yeah. It doesn't take a lot of money. It doesn't take a lot of money. You first want to get your staff trained. You want to demystify disability, as we've been talking about. So you want whoever you're going to bring in, you want that person to come into a welcoming environment. Right. Then you want to start thinking about what that experience is going to be like for a person who needs an accommodation. And so you want to explain the accommodations process. And everybody has some type of accommodations process. You want to tell them about it on the first day so that you make it easy for them to get whatever kind of work support they need in order to be effective. Then you've got to set some targets, because as a CEO, you're setting targets for everything else you want to get serious about. I won't say, well, you know, we don't do what we don't measure, but it is true, in fact. So you've got to set some targets. They can be very low targets to start out with. But you've got to set some targets and hold your managers accountable for meeting those targets, right? So far, I haven't talked about anything that's very expensive, right? Then you have to go out and find the right partners in the community to help you source candidates. Because as we've talked about before, this is a group of people that's been pretty systematically left out of mainstream society.
Hmm. Where do you tap into this population?
Women,
sure.
Right. You can't, it's also a very heterogeneous population. So it's people who are spread around all over the place who aren't necessarily disclosing their disabilities because of this stigma. So you have to work a little bit harder to find those candidates that you're going to want to bring in and to match them up to your particular labor force
mm-hmm.
needs.
Yes, sure.
But that's a matter of going out and figuring out who's who in the community. Actually, my organization has a couple of supports for a CEO like that are very inexpensive to access. We start with our Disability Employment Tracker. It's an online confidential self-assessment tool. 80 questions. It takes less than 2 hours to complete the tool. It's free. You go and you see where you might have some places that you need to shore up before you start hiring. Free, right? Then you want to go out. When you go out into the community, it might be hard to find people. So take an organization like mine and or others, and you say, help me screen the sources of labor. And there's some fabulous community organizations that help identify and train and on board people with disabilities. They're out there. You just have to find them. You have to know who's good and who's bad. And that's where it takes a little bit of help from an organization who can understand both your labor force needs, but also understand the candidate pool and how they're going to succeed. So it's really as systematic as recruiting any other part of the workforce that might be new or different. Think about what you did when you want to bring women in, when you want to bring African Americans in or Latinos.
What conduit? Where are your postings placed, et cetera? Just a little bit differently, that's all.
How are you portraying yourself to the public? When someone goes on the REI website, do you see someone in a wheelchair? Just as a way of symbolizing that you are a culture that's going to be welcoming to a person with a disability when they come in.
Or when you think of a store like Home Depot, when you walk in, is there a person in a chair, which happened to me recently, and he was in a chair. And I bring this up because it just it's makes me feel good because he walked up to me and said to me, "Hey, I saw you." He was at one of my talks. And it was so great to embrace him. And it was just great because I know the local Home Depot because I'm a renovation junkie. So I kind of live there. Mm-hmm. But it was just so great to see a company like that. And very quickly, just remind me of a story. There is a chain of car washes that have been growing in Florida area. And I think it's a father, son, or two sons. The son had autism and I think got out of school and they didn't know what to do. The whole family was lost. So he started a car wash. And I think it's up to two or three now where the majority, 80-90% of the workforce right there has autism somewhere on the spectrum. And I think that's great. It's called something like Soapy Suds or something like that. And it's very effective. They do very well. And it's a great, great product for them because it's about repetition.
Yes, that's
so
right.
So lastly, before we go and meet a Paralympian, Carol Glazer, what about someone who's listening with a disability? Where should they go?
Oh, well, of course I'm going to say, if I may, just unabashedly plug my own organization because this is our passion. This is what we spend all our lives doing. Go to NOD.org, National Organization on Disability.org, and then go to your local independent living center. They're wonderful organizations. They exist in every single community. New York has an abundance. All you have to do if you're in New York City is go to the mayor's office on disability.
Mayor's office
simply
people
go
with disabilities,
Go and Google disability in New York City, and you're going to find some very, very wonderful organizations led by very talented people.
Including
who can help with anything.
A fine parade that they had for the first time last year.
Wonderful.
Or actually, no, it was earlier this month, correct?
Earlier this month.
Yeah.
Disability Pride.
It
was wonderful.
Yeah, I speak of the one in New Jersey.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it gets bigger and bigger
all
the time.
Oh, it does. It's amazing. Every time Christy shows up, it gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, that's
Carol Glazer.
Thank
you, it was
you,
really
Mark.
Nice to meet you.
It's a pleasure.
And we're
going to
come back with a Paralympian right after this message.
PRN. Progressive Radio Network.
Giant Stadium, the longest show ever for Bruce Springsteen, and the longest recorded show in the history of live performances. And we got to get our next guest on, Allison Jones, elite athlete. She's got 1 foot on a plane in Colorado. She is Rio bound. Allie, how are you?
I'm fantastic.
Thank you so much for being very, very patient because our last guest got a little caught in the rain here. You know how New York is a little slower in the rain because we just don't know how to drive. Are you stoked or what?
Oh, of course. Yeah, going through team processing right now and it's, you know, 8 times, but it's still a fun time.
Now, what is team processing? Does that tell you after your event you shouldn't go out and get inebriated and rip stuff off the wall and pretend somebody pulls a gun on you?
Yeah, that was definitely a part of the team ambassador program that we all have to listen to, and for sure.
8-time Paralympian in alpine skiing and cycling, 8 Paralympic medals, including 2 gold, baby, and 9-time world champion in cycling. That's Allie Jones, and I'm so happy to have her on the phone. And thank you so much for giving us a few minutes before you literally get on a plane headed towards Rio. What was it that initially got you into cycling? Because you were born without a femur, and you were just like any other kid, and you just wanted to get on a bike, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those, I actually learned how to ski first at a really young age, and I was looking for things to do during the summer. I started with swimming, and then I saw paracycling, and next thing you know, I was on trying out for the national team, and it was a really amazing adventure as a 15-year-old.
Wow. 15 years of age. Incredible. So now you're going to be competing in the 500 meter and 3K pursuit on the velodrome and the individual time trials. So the velodrome, for people who are not cyclists and or don't watch Olympics in terms of that regard, if you've seen those tracks that almost, they're very oval-like and are on a major, major angle, that is called a velodrome, and they're incredibly, wickedly cool to watch because it's the closest thing you get to flying on land, right, Allison?
I would have say so. I mean, coming off the embankment, it's 45-degree down, so you're looking three stories down at sometimes, depending on the track. And
wow,
the sound of the wood, because it's hollow, you're usually riding on a wood surface on skinny tires that aren't even an inch wide. And it's all about going as fast as you can.
What's top speed you typically race on a velodrome?
Oh, I'm slow compared to some of the guys, but you can see speeds up to like 60 miles an hour.
6-0?
6-0, not from me, but from a lot of the guys. When you're watching the full sprinters, it's a pretty fast sport.
And how about top speed for Allison Jones?
Top speed's more like around 35.
35 is huge. I mean, those are posted speed limits for cars, for crying out loud.
Only can hold it for a short amount of time, but it's definitely a thrill ride when you're done and you can shoot straight up to the top and not worry about falling over or having enough speed.
So what made you, it's one thing, you know, to become a skier and a cyclist as a kid, because we all like to cycle because it's freedom. You get away from your parents and hang out with your kids. But what is it inside you, Allison Jones, that makes you an ultimate competitor?
You know, I just love competing. I love pushing myself to the next level. I mean, even if it's just a little personal goal in a non-competitive sport, it's one of those things I always like to see, you know, improvement or growth. Ultimately, it's also about, you know, having fun and at the end of the day, ending the day on a smile.
Do you think if you didn't have a disability, you would be this competitive?
Oh, yes, for sure. Yeah. My family is competitive. My sister plays soccer. She got invited to play for like a amateur but pro team right out of high school. And my mom was a swimmer. My dad was a sailboat racer. So I think it's in the blood.
Oh, my God. No grass grows under the Jones family's feet, that's for sure. And so when you're not racing on a bicycle or going downhill at a crazy top-notch speed with skis on your feet, you are a mechanical engineer in a very respectable field. So, I mean, obviously you're an all-around high achiever.
Yeah, I mean, I went to school knowing that I was mechanically inclined and wanted to be an engineer. I didn't know how to go to class without a calculator in my hand. And it just grew from there, and my passion for sports kind of helped me blend the two together, and so creating devices for people with physical disabilities that are at the high end of their competitive level, making it happen for them. So either out of carbon fiber or out of 3D printing with my company that I help work at. I should say I was kind of there when my best friend started it. Titan Robotics. So we definitely, my eye for helping those out that want to go faster, I've got a close one on it.
Wow. It's just like any other sport, because it's all about the gear and the tools and the machinery to be faster, lighter, and more competitive at any edge, correct?
Correct. I mean, you got to start with a good engine. So whoever there is driving it, you can't just lollygag around. But, you know, being able to fine-tune it and help open potentials is also a fantastic realization and thing to be a part of.
In addition to a lot of things that we like together, you don't know this about me, but I'm visually impaired, and I also love cycling, because I never stopped cycling, because when I couldn't get a license when I was 17, I never got off a bicycle, do triathlons, et cetera, and I love going fast. I'm a road cyclist. Always wanted to go down a velodrome and just haven't, because just proximity-wise, but also we share a passion for music, and I realized that you have a passion for jazz as well, because you have two cats called Miles and Davis. Very cool.
Yes.
Very cool.
Now, if we had a boy and girl, it'd be Etta James.
Oh, good. We got to meet, Allie. Man, this is just great stuff. you're very, very cool. And congratulations. You got married last year to the woman of your dreams?
Yeah, we actually got married in 2014.
Okay, you shouldn't take that long to respond, Allie.
Well, Colorado, it got sort of legalized once and then legalized again.
Gotcha.
So we actually have two wedding dates. We just I got to remember which one it is.
Gotcha. And also, you know, you got a lot going on today. You know, you're getting on a plane, going to a little thing called the Paralympics. In Rio. Good for you. Good for you. And there's one thing that I'm sure is going to be a source of further fueling you when you're doing the 500 meter and 3K is the unfortunate passing of your dad. My condolences. But I'm sure he was a staunch advocate and so very, very proud of all that you accomplished, whether you earned any single medals or not.
Yeah, no, he was my go-to guy on the engineering side because he has that tinker mind and knew how to help me put together what I was thinking. He'd already experienced it, so it was a great, great guy to hang out with and just like minds, hanging out, playing with carbon fiber, building stuff, and hanging. It was an awesome relationship that I had, and he'll be there in spirit and with everybody rooting behind us.
So I'm sure Rio's going to have a little special extra feeling for you this year.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Most definitely.
So now, no more winter sports, right? You're done? You're just sticking to cycling, correct?
Right now it's just the cycling. I haven't skied since the 2014 year.
Slacker.
I skied a couple times. I went and did a fun race, and I did win it. I haven't lost the edge quite yet. I don't see going back to ski racing, but skiing does have a huge part in me.
Absolutely. And you can tell it's evident. Do you like Bruce Springsteen?
I do.
All right. Well, I was there the other night, along with half the world. And Allison Jones, I can't thank you enough for your time. You're going to do well. And just do yourself a favor. Bask in the atmosphere that you've worked so incredibly hard to gain another position on a team that's so highly regarded, the Paralympic cycling team. And you're in great company. Will Lockenauer was on the show a couple weeks ago. He speaks highly of you. You're well respected.
Yeah.
And I wish you nothing but the best. And please give us a call when you get back on U.S. soil and talk about all the things you didn't get arrested for.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Kick some real butt, Allison Jones. My name is Mark Farrell. Have a great Labor Day weekend. Next weekend, we're going to be playing the top songs of summer 2016. Email me at mark@markfarrellmotivation.com. mark@markfarrellmotivation.com. Give me your top five songs. Have a great, incredible summer. Gene Wilder, you'll be missed. Carol Glazer, thank you. Allison Jones, all the best to you in Rio. My name is Mark Farrell. Special thanks to all the PRN. Incredible people here. Have a great weekend.